Welcome if you're joining us at the Racecourse or Shoreham or the Villas site in Hove. We've been learning about the story of this man Nehemiah and what happened through his leadership in that city. If you're new here, my name's Joel. I'm one of the leaders in the church, and we have teaching from the Bible every week. So let's read from verses 1 to 14. Now, when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab and the rest of our enemies heard that I had built the wall and that there was no breach left in it, although up to that time I had not set up the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent to me, saying, "Come and let us meet together at Hekephrim in the plain of Ono." When someone invites you to a meeting in Ono, that's a clue, okay? But they intended to do me harm. And I sent messengers to them saying, "I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you?" And they sent to me four times in this manner, and I answered them in the same manner. In the same way, Sanballat, for the fifth time, sent his servant to me with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem also says it, that you and the Jews intend to rebel. That is why you are building the wall. And according to these reports, you wish to become their king. And you've also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem, there is a king in Judah. And now the king will hear of these reports. So now come and let us take counsel together." Then I sent to him saying, "No such things as you say have been done, for you are inventing them out of your own mind. For they all wanted to frighten us, thinking, 'Their hands will drop from the work and it will not be done.' But now, O God, strengthen my hands." Verse 10. Now when I went into the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was confined to his home, he said, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. They are coming to kill you by night." But I said, "Should such a man as I run away? What man such as I could go into the temple and live? I will not go in." And I understood and saw that God had not sent him, but he had pronounced the prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this purpose he was hired, that I should be afraid and act in this way and sin, so they could give me a bad name in order to taunt me. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, according to these things that they did, and also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid." Okay, let me start by talking about you and your story. You each of you have a background story to your life, a story so far. Some of you have a sense of ongoing story. There's a sense of destiny or kind of sense of purpose you have. You want to achieve something in your life. You want to get something done. Maybe if you're young, you're thinking, you know, there's a huge plan that you're setting out right now. Maybe if you're at a later stage in life, it's more about a legacy that you want to leave behind. It's something that you want to get done, you know, at the closing stages of life. But you've got some sense of purpose and story, perhaps. And I would at least want to just ask the question, where do we get that idea from? Because if you think about it, it doesn't really make any sense if there's no God. If there's no purpose, there's no creator, there's no ultimate meaning to the world, if we're really nothing more than random stuff that's accidentally been thrown into existence. And if you, therefore, are nothing more than just a product of kind of molecules in between your ears, just random stuff. If that's all you are, then your sense of purpose and destiny and story is an illusion. It's not real. And the sense we might have of a thing to be done, a good thing that must get done in my life, and some bad problems that will get in my way, some obstacles, that's an illusion. There is no good. There is no bad. There are no goodies or baddies. There's no dragons to slay or giants to kill or enemies to overcome. There's no such thing. It's all an illusion. Now, if that's the case, I find it hard to understand, I guess, how powerful the illusion is. Because let's face it, every time we watch a good film or, a good play or read a good book, we're kind of caught up with the story. Stories are powerful in our minds. We feel drawn into them. We do want right to win. We do want evil to be defeated. We want the right outcome. We care. Why should we care if the world is meaningless? I think the care that we have about good and bad and purpose and destiny is a clue about who we really are. This book teaches that we really are made by a designer who has a plan. He has a big story that he's marching towards. He is seeing to it that history goes the way he wants it to. He has a plan involving actually his son and a city that his son will build and rule through for eternity. A city that he will rule through over everything. That's the story this book tells you. Right at the start, when God calls the big kind of granddaddy of the faith, Abraham, what he shows Abraham is this vision of an eternal city. And then at the end of the book, you get this city coming down out of heaven. This city that God will reign amongst and reign through over everything. And when you get to stories like this one in the Bible, Nehemiah, where you see a man trying to build God's city, in this sense, the physical city called Jerusalem in the Middle East, he's right there at the coalface in the midst of God's big story. This might seem like an ancient story that may not be relevant, but now listen, it's part of God's overarching big story. And so there are lessons we can learn by looking at Nehemiah and thinking, well, if I'm called to a great, great big story, great big purpose that's bigger than my own personal one, my own personal little sense of destiny that I might have. I mean, all of us, we come into life, maybe you come into church or come to God with your own personal dream of what you want to do. And part of becoming a Christian is kind of saying, okay, I'm going to let go of some of my dreams. I'm going to put my dream aside in favor of God's bigger, greater, happier, more glorious dream. But when you get involved in God's big dream, God's big urban dream, as we might call it, you realize it's not simple. God does have an enemy. There is such a thing as evil. There is something that wants to squash the plan of God. There is something that you come up against if you're following Jesus and trying to do his will, just like Nehemiah does here. So when we read this story of Nehemiah and the different ways that his enemies try and take him out, it's instructive for us. Because right here, they try and defeat him. They try and defeat him through distraction. They try and defeat him by criticism. And they try and defeat him by fear. So I'm going to use the rest of the time to look at how that works. How does he respond? And this will help you, because each of you that wants to do something great with your life, we'll have to face these issues. Here you have some wisdom from God's book. Okay, so let's look at how it works here. The first thing we notice is this distraction one. Verse 2, Sanballat and Geshem sent to me saying, come and let us meet together at Hekepharim in the plain of Ono, but they intended to do me harm. So what they're doing is they're inviting him to a meeting. And if you know the story, you know these guys haven't been Nehemiah's biggest fans. They've criticized him quite a lot. They've mocked him. They've basically been sort of dissing him from chapter 2, chapter 3. From the early stages, they've tried to get at him. Now they've seemed to change their tune a bit, because they're saying, let's have a meeting. And it's in the context of what's happened in verse 1, where they can see that he's built the wall and he's only got the gates left to finish. I mean, the construction's nearly done. The builders are nearly done. It's like, wow, this guy's—he's nearly finished. And so, instead of just attacking him now, they try a kind of flattery thing. They try to say, "Oh, come to a special meeting with us. We'd like to sit down and discuss some things and talk this through." And Nehemiah has to decide whether he's going to respond to this invitation. And a lot of your life is spent in deciding what invitations to accept, what things to say yes to and what things to ignore. You have to carefully evaluate, what are the things I want to get involved with? What are the things I'm going to give precious time and energy and thought to? What are the things that are actually completely irrelevant to me? And to make those decisions, you have to, first of all, decide, what is the work that I'm called to do? What is the thing that I know I must do above all things? If you don't know that, you'll just be forever at the mercy of people's pressure. Because people will use pressure. They'll use intimidation. They'll manipulate you. They'll bully you. They'll make you feel, I really ought to go to this, or I really ought to do this, I really ought to be sacrificial towards this, because what else? If I don't do that, I'll put these people out. I'll upset those people. They'll think badly of me, or maybe they'll say badly about me. So I really ought to get involved, I really ought to do it. Our lives can end up being just a bizarre kind of mixture of different things that we've been pressured into doing without knowing why we're doing them. You ever found that in your life? You just go one thing to another, you think, what actually is the thread that links all these beads together? Nothing. I'm just going along with other people's whims. I suppose I ought to be, because I don't really want to put people out. Nehemiah has to face this invitation. What shall I do when they invite me along? And Nehemiah's response, verse 3, is quite instructive. He says, I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. I'm doing a great work. I'm doing a great work. Now, I don't think that's him being proud. I think it's him realizing that the stuff he's already doing is greater than what he's being invited to. And it takes, I think, a mixture of wisdom and kind of guts to believe that sometimes, right? Because the things that we can be invited to, well, not only can they come with pressure, they can even come with flattery. They can kind of massage our egos. What, you want me to come to that? You want me to do this? And we get really excited about being invited into some situations or asked to do certain things that take up a lot of our time and energy. And you think, but they asked me. And then before we know it, we're giving our time and our commitment because, well, it just flattered us. It just made me feel important. It's embarrassing how this kind of thing happens. I can think of loads of times in my life where it's been. A few years ago when I was starting to lead the thing called New Day, which is a big youth event we do nationally, there was a magazine that wanted me to, they asked me to be on their editorial board, a youth magazine. And a national magazine, I was like, wow, I'm on the editorial. I can see my name in the front cover of this. Every month it came out, I got the magazine through the post, so I just opened it up. It's my monthly fix for my ego, looking at this. My name is in there, just look right there, going around the office, you know, leaving it conspicuously at people's desks, just kind of trying to get some sense of perspective about this I was like this is really exciting. It's pathetic, I know. I mean, it's embarrassing telling you now, and I don't really want to tell you, but there you go. I think what was happening to me was I was allowing a slight flattery to make me commit to something that really I had no ability to do anyway. I couldn't give time to being an editor of this mag, or, you know, helping them edit. And they would call me, you know, every month or so, saying, you know, what do you think? Have you got any thoughts? I'd be like, well, you know, I had a quick skim. I hadn't had any time. It was a stupid commitment. And they'd say, well, do you really want to give time to this? And I'd say, well, possibly. Maybe I could do it in my own way. I'll give you an occasional email once every 6 months with some thoughts. The guy said, yeah, it's fine. I said, would I still have my name in there? The guy said, no. So, oh, well, I'm not sure. And, you know, it's ridiculous, horribly embarrassing, but this is an example of how little things that flatter can draw us into stuff that's just distracting. It's not what we're called to do. What's the thing that is your calling? And when you know what it is, treat it like Nehemiah treats his calling. He says, I am about a great work. I really like that, don't you? I'm doing a great work. Well, you're just building a wall, right? No, I'm not. I'm building God's city. He understood that what he was doing was eternally important. It was about God's big story. You see, other people will try to get you into things that will potentially knock you off God's eternal plan for your life. And your challenge will be not allowing what seems important right now because it's the new fad, It's the thing other people are talking about. It's got your name in it. I don't know, just there could be something that will just get your attention. And you'll think, well, what I'm doing is tiny compared to this, really. And you just got to keep your wisdom about you. You got to keep perspective. What is the thing? What is the thing that you must do with your life? And see it like Nehemiah sees it. I'm doing a great thing. I think people watching this on video in Shoreham Racecourse Hove, maybe people here who are parents need to hear this. See, parenting is not necessarily considered the most, I don't know, sensational enterprise on planet Earth. It's not going to grab the headlines. They're not going to write up some huge six-page spread in a Sunday supplement one day about how well Mr. and Mrs. Jones of Kemp Town, Brighton, raised their children over 16 years. That's not exactly exciting and thrilling, but you need to understand, anybody who says, I'm going to build a household on the gospel of Jesus Christ, I'm going to raise children well and love them and train them and teach them to know God. If that's your ambition, it is great. Truly great. It is a great thing you are doing. And parents can feel so pressurized. I've got to be at the meeting with my boss. I've got to do the overtime. I've got to show. I've got to impress the team. I've got to do more hours than anyone else in the office. I've got to be the last one to leave. My office light needs to be on the longest. I need to show. I need to climb the ladder. I've got to be. And what we're saying is what happens at home is not great. My career prospect is great. This is kind of domestic, kind of boring. It's kind of what other people should worry about. I've got a great career. You've got it so wrong. What is the great thing? Many who watch this will be stay-at-home mums who actually face this a lot because it's the, you know, again, one of the most despised callings in the world, especially in our culture here in the West. Cities like Brighton, you don't get a lot of accolades, but listen, you're doing a great thing. You need to know it's not wrong for you in your given situation to say no to distractions. I find it impressive when I'm with someone. You know, I have to be in a few different situations where leaders get together and plan their diaries and say, let's meet on this time, let's meet on that time. I hate those times. Because I'm always the one that has to, well, I feel like I'm often the one that has to say, oh, I can't meet then. Because life's just full, you know, life's crazy busy. But what I love, I get inspired by some guys who I've noticed, just over the years, I've noticed some guys who just say, I can't meet then. And you're waiting for them to try and trump your reason for why they can't meet. Because, you know, you've got different hierarchy of what's important. What's a good reason to miss this? Well, I'm sorry, I'm meeting with the president of Bolivia on that day. Yes, I have a very important meeting at number 10 that day. Okay. And you kind of think, you know, obviously in the world, there's, oh, this is really important. I love it when guys just say, I'm busy. Because what they're saying is, you don't need to know. It's my priority. This is the thing that I'm called to do. I'm busy. And then you've got permission to do that. You know, in certain settings, we might have to feel awkward because the thing that you're prioritizing, you know, say if someone's trying to pressurize you into something, you look at your diary and you realize that's the day I was going to spend praying, or that's the afternoon I was going to, that's the hour I usually spend praying or reading my Bible, and someone wants to push me out of that, and you don't want to give that as a reason. You think, oh, that's going to sound really pathetic. I can't, you know, I bet this person never prays. By the way, I'll give you a tip. You don't have to say you're going to pray. You just say, I'm meeting with someone very important then. That's fine. You find your way, but stick to it. What's the great work? What's the great work? Do the great work. Well, it's not very great. Just finishing an essay, that's not very great. It's a great work. It's a great work. Filling in your forms, sorting this out, dealing with the kids, it's a great work. Prioritize these things well. See it the way Nehemiah saw it. He's not so easily distracted away. But let's look at the second thing, because it doesn't stop with distraction. It goes on to criticism, and this is a tougher one, perhaps. It's more painful. You see in verse 5 where they start sending out these open letters. The same way Sanballat for the fifth time sent his servant to me with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, it's reported among the nations, and Geshem also says it. By the way, when someone drops a name in on a rumor, it's like, you see what they're doing? They're trying to throw in a name. And this is supposed to make Nehemiah wet his pants, that Geshem is involved. Oh dear, Geshem. Oh, didn't tell me about Geshem. But, you know, it's just an intimidation tactic. He says it, that you and the Jews intend to rebel. That is why you are building the wall, and according to these reports, you wish to become their king. You see what they're doing? And you have also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem, there is a king in Judah. And now the king will hear of these reports. So now come and let us take counsel together. Look, if we can't distract you from Jerusalem with a meeting, we'll distract you with criticism to make you defend yourself, to make you get into a fight. That's what they're doing. And it's an open letter. It's right out there in the public sphere. It's not a private letter. It's an open public. It would have been read by loads of people between the time it got written and the time that Nehemiah saw it. This is basically the equivalent of an internet flame war. It's the equivalent of a big Facebook post or a tweet that gets loads of retweets. That's what it is. And it's niggling at Nehemiah. It's aiming at his really sort of tender sweet spot. It's attacking him. And Nehemiah, he is not a self-asserting, arrogant man. Think about it. This guy's given up his job with the king of Persia. He's given up the highest career prospect that a Jew could have had at that time so as to take on a life-threatening job building a burned-out city on the edge of the Persian Empire. He is not in it for the money. He's not in it for the power. He knows he could get killed any day. He is a humble servant of God, and yet they're daring to say, this man is an empire builder. That's what they're saying. People will look at the commitments that you make, the decisions that you make. People will look at the priorities you set, the invitations that you decline, the tough stances that you adopt. And they'll criticize you for the precise opposite of what you really are. Nehemiah, wow. How painful it must have been for this man who gave up so much, who humbled himself so much, suffered so much, served so hard, to be publicly accused of empire building. That's what happens, I'm afraid, all too often. It's hard enough being criticized, but when you're criticized for the very opposite of what you're trying to do, I'm afraid that happens. I don't know about you, I've tasted some of that as a pastor of a church. People can say things, even out there publicly, even stuff that goes out there online, stuff that goes out there in the public sphere that's said about you. You think, that's exactly the opposite of what I believe. That's exactly the opposite of what I'm trying to do. But you've just decided to project your ideas onto me. If there's anyone in this story who is a power monger, it's Sambalat. He's assuming that Nehemiah is as well. Instead of thinking twice, thinking, what, wait a minute, that's not true of this man. But people will project all kinds of ugly motives on you if you follow Jesus wholeheartedly. This is a painful one. It's painful in so many, because rumors are really delicious and people love them. Facebook tweets, things that just go along. Like, wow, did you hear what they said? Did you? Have you seen it? Come on, look at my phone. Look at that. Have you seen? Look at this. I've got some proof. Look at that. Man, it just tastes so good. Look at the gossip, the chance to be part of this wave of rumor spreading. And it happens in church all the time. Wildfire can spread because of just strange rumors. As a team of elders, we have a slight allergy to when people say the words, well, a lot of people are saying. When I hear that in meetings, when guys say, well, a lot of people are saying this, that's when my brain, I just start going, la, 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 la. Because I don't care what a lot of people are saying. It's always complete exaggeration anyway. A lot of people, it's very powerful if you listen, if you allow it to get to you. I just think, I used to choose to ignore it. Remember years ago when one of the preachers in this church was making this point, basically. You know, the whole a lot of people are saying thing. And a lady I know went up to him at the end. He'd said, whenever I ask the question to somebody, how many have said this? The answer is always two. 2. And someone I know went up to him and said, a lot of people are saying how wonderful your sermon was when you made that point. And he said to her, how many? And she was like, oh my goodness, it was 2. He actually made it. So you get, I mean, that's almost a scientific fact. It's just, it's always going to be blown up out of proportion. Just listen, treat these big claims with a pinch of, just treat them wisely. Nehemiah's listening, okay, interesting. But he responds wisely. How does he respond? Let me go through a few things, okay? Quick ones, okay? First of all, he does speak. Okay, so verse 8, I sent him saying, no such things as you say have been done, for you are inventing them out of your own mind. I really like that. It's rubbish. Let's get back to work. He says something. Now, this proves there is a place for communicating. There is a place for sometimes saying, okay, can we just set the record straight? Here is my public comment. Here, I will go on record. Here is the line. That's necessary sometimes. Often, I mean, in church life, it's like that. Sometimes you have to say, okay, this is what we believe on this. Because people say a lot of things about what we believe, a lot of things about where the church is going, a lot of things about, you know, a lot of rumors. Okay, here's what we believe. Recently we did that. We did a vision night back in January. If you've not listened to the download, you should. It's on the website. It's necessary to just state, okay, for the record, this is where we're going. But state it out of a concern for the calling that God has for you, not out of a concern for your own profile. There's a big difference there. For Nehemiah, the stakes are not, how will I clear my name? He doesn't mind about that. You notice that as you read the book, this guy, it's not his big concern. If you're concerned about clearing your name all the time, you will get into no end of fights. I heard a guy say, with some people that you get into an argument with, it's like wrestling with a pig. You both get muddy, but the pig really likes it. You've got to decide, you know what, I'm just not gonna wrestle. I'm just not even gonna get in the ring. It's a waste of my time. And but it's so enticing, isn't it? How dare you say that? And we get back on the right, I'll give you a piece of mind. I'm flipping blog on this one. We really want to start respond, react, retaliate. Be careful. You're being baited. Don't need to. Find a way to say the truth and move on. Move on. Let other people have their wars, have their squabbles. You move on. You build the wall. It's interesting. Nehemiah's best answer in the end is that he builds the wall. In the end, that's the best thing you can do. Get on with the dream. Get on with God's urban dream. Build his city. Build what God wants you to build. Even under the fire of criticism, even with the arrows flying in, build the wall. Within time, I don't know how long a time, but I promise you, within time, you will silence your critics, not by arguing them into submission. Some people will never be argued into submission. But you build something that they can see. Eventually, their voices will wither. They have nothing to say. Look, the evidence is here. They've done it. That's what happens at the end of this story. Carry on building. Let the wall speak for you. And don't be conned by voices. There's so many voices, aren't there, that you can be distracted by. Maybe some of you, this has been your experience even recently. Or maybe for years, you you will find, if you really want to know God, that one of the fights you've got to have is with somebody called the accuser. That's one of the names for the devil. And he will accuse you day and night. He won't quit. He'll keep getting to you. He'll keep attacking you. And foolish Christians try and defend themselves. They try and tidy up their record. They try and say, no, I'm a good person, really. Or when people accuse them, when tongues wag, when rumors spread, they respond to every single one. Every single flame war, they're at it. Every single gossip, every whisper. What did you say about me? Why is that? It's because, I'll tell you why, the thing that they are living for the most is the respect of other people. They haven't yet laid down the need to be vindicated before men at every turn. And when you follow Jesus, you do have to lay down that need. You have to be prepared for your name to be a bit despised sometimes, for people to get the wrong end of the stick. And if it doesn't ruin the church, who cares? If it doesn't bring God's name into disrepute, who cares? It's not about me. That's a painful thing to say, but here's the thing. If you're listening to the one voice that counts, you will learn to care less about the other voices. It's difficult. I'm learning this even now. Still learning it, but I will learn it. And you must as well. You must. You know the story of the prodigal son? Wastes all his money, wastes his dad's money, wastes his life, goes out looking for prostitutes and gambling and drunkenness, comes back to his father. His father runs to him, hugs him, clothes him, feeds him, cleans him, honors him, vindicates him before the house. My son is found. But you need to know there would have been lots of other tongues wagging in the house. Lots of other statements made about him. The father says, "My son!" Everyone else said, "That guy, that scum, that layabout, that waster, that loser." The father says, "My son." Which voice will you listen to when you're being criticized? Which voice wins in your heart? You need to discipline yourself sometimes to just say, "No, I'm going to get back to the Father's voice about me." Do you do that? That's why you need time with God, not to keep the rules, but because there's so many voices. You need to listen to the one that counts. You need to be in this book drinking in the promises and the affirmations from God to keep you steady in the face of accusation and rumors. So he's learning to be tough, and he lets the wall speak. Let's look at the final one. We just got time. Verse 10. This one, it's a long reading. Let me just squash it down. "I went to the house of Shemaiah, and he said, 'Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. They are coming to kill you by night.'" What's going on here? Well, if you read it in the Hebrew, which I'm sure you've all done this week, this is written in verse. And as it says later, he's been hired to prophesy. This is a prophecy. He's saying, God says, okay, he's written it in religious, spiritual language, spiritual jargon, spiritual voice. I'm sure he said it in a very spiritual voice, a very Radio 4, thought for the day, kind of voice, just to make you feel a little bit sinful. That's how some people got that gift, don't they? The way they talk, they just make you feel a little bit spiritually inferior. And you feel, "Oh, I can't compete. You know more jargon. I can't compete. You've been to more conferences than me. You're spiritual. You've read paperbacks about spiritual things. And you know words that I don't know. And you can say prophecies." Nehemiah, by the way, was not a prophet or a priest. He's not even allowed in the temple. He's a eunuch. He wouldn't have been allowed in, literally. It's a whole other story. But he's not a spiritual guy in that sense. I reckon loads of you struggle with this. I do, and I'm a preacher, for goodness sake. People who spiritually intimidate because they put on a certain voice, have a certain way, sharing things. You feel a little, "Oh yeah, sharing something. The Lord has just shared with me just this morning to share with you." Oh no. You start coming out in a rash. "Oh, if God said it, I'm in trouble." What are you going to do in that? What are you going to do when someone who criticizes you says, "Oh, and the Lord told me as well"? I'm not exaggerating. In a subtle way, that's what people will be doing. "The Lord said this to me. The Lord shared this with me." Guys, see through it. Be wise. Don't assume it. Don't think, "Oh, it must be right." No. You need to be a bit more like Sherlock. You need to be like, "I think Moriarty's behind this." You need to think, "Well, wait a minute. The devil, he's cleverer than you think. He will put on a spiritual voice. He will. He'll distract you. He'll attack you. He's clever. He knows that you love God. He knows that you fear God. He knows that you're humble. He knows that when God speaks, you tremble. So he says, oh, this is the Lord, actually. He'll do it. He'll be so cunning. Nehemiah, he's sharp. He's shrewd. Wait a minute. Is that the Lord? Let's test it. First of all, you just asked a eunuch to come into the temple. It says, actually, in the law, that's not allowed. Straight away, he's thinking, what does the scripture say? That's important. Do you understand? He's back in the book. He's thinking, okay, if God said it here, or if it fits in with what God said here, then maybe it's possible. If it's a distraction and a contradiction of what God has already said to me, I don't care how much of a spiritual voice you put on when you say it, it's rubbish. You've got to be careful, guys. You've got to discern. Just because something takes on the airs and graces of spirituality, it isn't necessarily so. So ask questions in your heart. Does this fit in with what God has said? Sometimes people will say to you, well, I think God... I mean, as a pastor, this happens to me about weekly. People say, well, I think God told me to do this. Or not even I think. It's like, I'm going to do this. Why? Because God said. Well, I can't argue with him. That's the end of the argument. Like, all right, then. God told you. But God didn't tell me. We're not going to be intimidated, you know? I've told you this before, I guess. My mum was age of some of you girls. She had a guy come up to her and say, the Lord's told me that you're going to marry me. And she said, well, he hasn't told me. You're allowed to just poke a few questions to test it. You're allowed to. It's not wrong, okay? You mustn't be intimidated by a certain style, certain tone. You just got to look wisely at it. Think what's really going on under the surface here. Nehemiah's wise. He asks good questions. Being gracious doesn't mean being gullible. And he stands, listen, this is, I guess, the last thing I need to say. He stands in his authority. Authority. Look at verse 11. He says this. I said, should such a man as I run away? Should I run away? Isn't that great? I love that phrase. That's one of the most heroic moments in the book. Should I run away? What's he saying? Is he saying, you're talking to Nehemiah, I am the guy, I'm not going to run away? No, he's not saying that. He's not full of himself. What do you mean when he says, should such a man as I run away? What he means is this. I am under authority. It's not my decision. I have a very powerful boss. I have a great work to do, and I'm under authority. See, the way that your enemy, the one who hates you and wants to destroy you, the way he has worked from the beginning is to distract you from your authority giver. That's what he did in the very beginning, on the very first page of the Bible. He came to the man and the woman whom God had placed in the garden and given authority to. And he said, you know the words that your master gave you? I'm not really sure about those words. I'm not really sure if you should listen to him. And the Lord had said to them, you're in charge of this garden over everything, every living thing in this garden. That includes snakes. And a snake came to them and said, I'm not so sure about his words. And he was cunning. He was clever. He made them think a certain way. He's been doing it ever since. What he does is he causes us to tremble. He causes us to come under his authority. He causes us to stay awake at night thinking, what if, well, what if that, what if that, and worrying, and not doing the things that we're called to do because we're worried about, well, what, if I obey God, it might go wrong. I might get into trouble if I stick with God. If I don't rush into the temple to be safe, who knows, I could die. They're coming to kill me, apparently. Imagine the fear that could have grown in his heart if he hadn't stayed under authority. I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to run away. I've been sent here. I'm keeping my post, doing what God has told me. I know it's supposed to be safe in the temple. You can get sanctuary in the temple. Oh, yeah, that's fine. It can be safe in the temple for people that are going to go in there. But the safest place for me is in the will of God, right here. Safest place for you is in God's will. You have authority right there. No one's ever done that. No one has ever held completely their post. We've all drifted a bit. Even Nehemiah fails in some ways. Every one of us has got a past of failing to keep to God's standard. We've got a past of blowing it, rebelling against his plan. There's only ever been one man who kept under authority perfectly and therefore stayed in authority and had power. He said, no one can take my life from me. I lay it down willingly. Only one man has ever done that. And Jesus Christ on the cross, he won back from evil the authority that Adam had lost. He won it back for you. Not for himself, he had it already. He won it back for you. So because of Jesus, because of his blood, because of his death and his resurrection over death, you, no matter what a failure you feel like, even if you think I'm weak, I'm useless, I'm hopeless, like Nehemiah. I mean, Nehemiah's a eunuch. You've got to understand that's a big deal. He's a weak guy. In that culture, that was a write-off, right? Understand? It's like you just, this guy's a nobody. He could have easily thought, well, God doesn't love me. I'm not welcome in the temple. I can't have a relationship with God. He doesn't think. He understands somehow, in some way, he understood God's grace. He understood that God was with him, even out there on the wall, far from the temple, far from safety. He was safe. And the only way that could be true is if someone else who came along and said, I am greater than the temple. Matthew chapter 12. There is one here who is greater than the temple. There is one here who provides the safety that no one else can provide. No building, no ritual, no religion can provide the safety that Jesus provides. Some of you, you've been looking for safety and affirmation and comfort. You've got it from all the wrong things, and those things will bite you. Jesus alone can give you safety, affirmation, comfort. And when you're in his will, you are safe. You're safe from criticism, from distraction, even from fear and intimidation.